Okay, welcome to the G&JB show, episode number 53. Jack Bowen, how are you, mate?
I'm good, Wydax. How are you, mate?
Very well, mate. Today we have Grantley Keyser. How are you, Grantley?
Oh, very well. Thank you very much for having me on the podcast. I listen to them and they're excellent. They really are very, very interesting.
Excellent, mate. We thought you'd have many stories being the journalist that you are and the author. We thought it'd be exciting to have you on the show, and I'm sure you've got many stories for us.
Thank you. Yeah, it's interesting that you've got me on this week, because next week is the launch of my new book, Knockout, which the ABC is going to be promoting all month on ABC TV and on ABC Radio. And it's essentially just my favourite stories out of boxing. I spent 40 years covering the sport, a bit more than 40 years, actually. And not just as a journalist, but of course I was heavily involved in the careers of Jeff Fenech and Jeff Harding, Joe Bugner, even a little bit of Love Morton Dew in the corner for those fighters. And very, very fortunate to have all those experiences and those stories to relate.
Well, whatever we can do to help you wherever needed, we'll put our little bit of effort in there.
Thank you, yeah.
Mate, so with our guests, we always go back to where it started. Where were you born? How did you grow up? And let's evolve from there.
Yeah, well, I was born in Ballarat, Victoria. My parents lived next door to my grandfather on a dairy farm down there. He was a World War I veteran who came back from World War I absolutely hating war. He'd seen friends of his blown apart not far from him on the Western Front. He came back and he was a very upright, very strong guy. He liked boxing. He liked watching boxing. In the 1960s, we had a couple of great champions in Lionel Rose and Johnny Famechon, and he was a mad fan. But when I was quite young, we left Ballarat and moved to Brisbane, and I grew up on the north side. It was originally called Aspley, and then they hived it off and it became Bridgman Downs, and I was lucky enough to grow up on an acreage out there. Nearly all our neighbours all had 2.5 acre blocks. We had horses and cows, and we used to play test match rugby league in the front yard with the neighbours, and in the summertime test match cricket. it was terrific. And I remember in Gympie Road, Aspley, the suburb that I lived in became Bridgman Downs, but in Gympie Road, Aspley, the local barber, an old barber called Jack the Barber. It's like a shop out of the 1940s. This is the late 1960s. But yeah, he had a photo on his wall of the barber shop, just like a Catholic might have a photo of the Pope. He had Johnny Famechon. And I was quite intrigued by that. And I remember at the time my brother knew a lot more about boxing than me, but we watched Johnny Famechon fighting Harada from Japan. And Famechon, it was very exciting. They'd fought a very close fight a little while earlier, and in the rematch, Famechon, who wasn't noted as a big puncher, drove Harada through the ropes and won by a stoppage in the closing stages. Very exciting, and that sort of made me very enthusiastic about boxing, because Johnny Famechon was such a hero. And I remember as a little boy hearing that Lionel Rose had been beaten, and people were very downcast about it. He'd gone over to America and got stopped by Ruben Olivares. And so all these things were quite fascinating to me, much more so than rugby league or cricket at the time. And I became very interested in boxing. And Muhammad Ali at the time came back from his exile. He spent 3 years out of boxing because he refused to be drafted. And he was a real cult hero, I guess, almost like a messianic figure, a religious figure. He had such a hold on people. And he came back and got beaten by Joe Frazier. And I remember my brother being downcast about that and saying that, you know, it was only because he'd spent so long out of the game. And then I remember very late one night, we stayed up late and we watched from Africa Ali regain the title against George Foreman in Kinshasa Zaire, and that was absolutely fascinating. And so I dabbled in a little bit of boxing at the local sports club. I didn't do any fighting myself. I'm only about 10 or 12 at this stage, but as time progressed on, became more and more involved in it. And when I was 17, I left high school and started working for the old Brisbane Telegraph, which was an afternoon newspaper in Brisbane. It's since folded, as all the afternoon newspapers have done as the media winds down. But I started there, and at the time, the promoter in Brisbane was a real tough old guy called Reg Layton. Yep. And he promoted fights with Wally Taylor. They had a car yard over on the south side at Woolloongabba. And Reg was the promoter, and I started covering boxing for the paper, which I absolutely loved. I remember the very first fight that I covered was Tony Mundine against Steve Axel. And
was that Festival Hall?
It was at Festival Hall. It was their second fight. They'd fought in Sydney once before, and Mundine had won in 12 rounds. And in the rematch, Axel always jokes every time I see him that he got caught with a lucky punch or two, about 300 of them. And Mundine was incredibly fast. You know, Tony Mundine, he was absolutely dynamite. And I became quite friendly with both those guys over time, and I became the resident boxing writer there. I did a little bit of boxing training, not fighting. And after 2 years in Brisbane, I got... And I covered lots of fights up here. I remember Frank Ropus against Hector Thompson, who was on the downside of his career. Young Brian Jansen was coming along. There was lots of really great fighters at Festival Hall in those days. I remember a very, very big heavy puncher called Steve Dennis. He was absolute power puncher. The fighters that I used to interview would say that even when they hit them on the arms, it was like their arms were breaking. He's such a powerful guy, very nice guy, but gee, he was a devastating puncher. So after a little bit less than 2 years in Brisbane, working for the Brisbane Telegraph, I got offered a better job in Sydney, and I went there and I spent the best part of the next 25 years there. And as soon as I got to Sydney, I started doing a little bit of training at the Newtown Police Youth Club, which was just a police boys club in the inner city of Sydney, and the trainer there was Johnny Lewis, and he had a very good fighter at the time called Jeff Malcolm, who'd been the Commonwealth light welterweight champion, was a very slick boxer. And Malcolm and I became quite friends. And Johnny also had a very good rising amateur. He was the New South Wales flyweight champion at the time, Jeff Fenwick. And of course, Jeff took over and became one of our greatest. Certainly the most successful Australian fighter. You know, it's subjective who was Australia's greatest fighter, but no one has won more world titles in such fashion as he did.
Yeah, wow. What a breeding ground for anybody around that gym at that time. I'm sure there's many, many people around that time with amazing stories from those gym wars that you would have seen in the day.
Well, I remember Lester Ellis and Graham Brooke coming up to spar with Jeff Fenwick as he rose through the ranks, and they were always very willing and a real education to watch those two guys go at it. And over time, Jeff morphed from just a wild sort of a slugger who used to wear opponents down to quite a good calculating boxer at the end of his career. He was really such a special talent, and I guess he was always an inspiration for everybody around him, and that what you can achieve with a bit of talent and real hard work and dedication, because he was very dedicated to his craft. He was a bit of a wild boy sometimes away from boxing, but you know, when it came to what he saw as his job, he was 100% focused and dedicated, and nobody trained harder. Johnny Lewis used to always say that, you know, I asked Johnny many times who he thought was better, because Johnny ended up, because of Jeff, Johnny ended up training so many of Australia's great fighters. Jeff Harding came to train with him when he was an amateur. Joe Bugner came when he wanted to make a comeback. And, of course, Kostya Zhu, when he turned professional, he'd been the world amateur champion. When he turned professional, he trained with Johnny. And I used to always say to Johnny, which one do you think's better, pound for pound, Jeff or Kostya? And he'd always say, Jeff was a better fighter than Kostya always round, because when you look at their careers, Jeff only had 28 amateur fights, and yet he should have won the gold medal. He was ripped off for a decision over in Los Angeles and ended up fighting the gold medalist 2 years later and absolutely smashing him, whereas Kostya had something like 350 amateur fights against the best fighters from around the world. And even in the gym, Jeff would do more in an hour than Kostya would do in two or three. Kostya would... A little bit like Manny Pacquiao, just go through the paces for a lot of the time, whereas Jeff was so intense and so ferocious at his task, you know, the way that he trained with such intensity. And no one could out-fitness him when he was fighting. That's the way he would fight. He would just wear people down, wear them down, and then pounce when they had nothing left.
So everything he did, was it like... Everything he did, it was a competition. Like if he ran against his mates in the gym. If he'd punch hard, is that how he is?
A couple of times, a couple of like athletic runners, you know, like 400 meter champions or 1500 meter champions would come to run with us, and Jeff would decide they'd run it another time because no one was allowed to get in front of him. He would always, because he was super fit, but he wasn't like an Olympic runner or whatever. He would pick his marks. Yeah.
Yeah, wow. Mate, I want to go back to, because I'm interested in the Festival Hall days.
Yeah.
The question I want to ask is, what changed? Why is boxing so different now to back then? Because as I hear, you'll be able to spread a bit more light on this. Fights were regular at Festival Hall. Fighters get pulled out of the crowd if somebody pulled out, and they just put their hand up and they wouldn't care. Where now everybody's trying to seemingly protect something, which, you know, is irrelevant. Like, what's the difference in between now and back then?
They were less sanitised times, I guess, in those days. You did have regular fights at Festival Hall, and you had guys who were willing to fight for little money. Now, a lot of fighters, of course, you know, the powers in their court, there's a lot of influence from social media, I guess, and they want to protect their records, and to lose a fight is almost like a career ender for a lot of people, when that's not the way it used to be. You know, even before the days of Festival Hall in the 50s and 60s, guys would fight every 2 or 3 weeks. Mm. Perhaps, in hindsight, not the best for their health. And as I say, they were less sanitised times. But you see also rugby league being watered down too, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. I mean, gee, some of the fighters who were footballers in the 50s and 60s, they played in an era when head-high tackles were common. You know, and if you got concussed, bad luck. You know, get back up. Yeah. You know, what's wrong with you?
You know? Well, even myself playing rugby league in a few different places, I remember many times, and this was in the 90s, getting, you know, bit dazed and standing up and just keep going. Yeah. But again, 20 years before, it was a totally different level.
I remember talking to Noel Kelly, who was a big fight fan, Noel Ned Kelly, and he was one of the great forwards of all time. He did a lot of amateur boxing as well, and he used to always come down to the Newtown gym to see Johnny Lewis because they were great mates. But in the days that he played, I mean, their shins would get ripped to pieces by spikes. There'd be head-high tackles all the time. You know, it was an era that he used to call catch and kill your own. He used to say, you know, he got sent off so many times himself because he was a pretty rough player. Is that mine? Sorry, mate.
That's all right.
I thought I'd switch that off. I'll switch it off.
Grantley's just taking phone calls.
Sorry. I'm in big demand. I thought I'd switch it off. There you go. Yeah, it's off. Yeah, he would say that in those days it was, you know, a case of catch and kill your own. He used to say that he got sent off so many times when the postman used to blow the whistle, he'd head for the shower if he was in the garden, because it was such a common thing for him. But that was it. That was the and all in brawls on the field were common. Very, very unlikely to incur the wrath of the referee if you punch someone in the head. It was just part of the game. And, you know, it's probably a good thing that that's all changed, really, for the health of the players. He used to say that it was accepted wisdom in the days when he was playing rugby league that you wouldn't drink before a game because it would slow you down. So they'd all go out there dehydrated. And, you know, he said, oh, geez, by the second half you were thirsty, I tell you.
Yeah, no shit.
Beer at halftime, I think.
Oh, man. I think, well, obviously the times would have been a lot different too. Like even you saying, you know, your grandfather went to war.
Yeah.
It'd be a lot harder and you know, even Vietnam, you know, you're saying when you first started getting into Ali, that all those things were present on that time too. So I think the blokes would have been a lot tougher and more resilient to what's going on around them.
Well, boxing was a much, in terms of participation, there would have been a lot bigger participation rates in boxing in those days. I mean, you used to do it at schools and used to do it in physical training, whereas now there's a lot more emphasis on boxer size and just looking good, really, isn't it? You know, rather than the manly art of self-defence, as they used to call it.
Yeah, no one tends to put their bad days in the office on their social media,
that's
do
right,
they?
That's right, yeah. It's all looking pretty, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So we go into schools and we work with kids in schools, but ours is a boxing program, but it's more of a mentoring program where we're sort of trying to mentor young men and how to make better decisions in their lives. And that's what a lot of people get through boxing. There are a couple of schools that actually do contact programs with us, which is pretty good, isn't it? You know, Ipswich High and a couple of others, they come and do some bit of a contact program, which is it's a step forward. But in a lot of people, Grantley, you'd be able to add a bit to this as well. A lot of people say, you know, the saying of boxing saves lives. It's also the people around those boxers, isn't it? It's not just the sport.
Yeah, of course. You know, and I was very, very lucky to have two great mentors in my life. Not that I was a scallywag or whatever, but coming through the ranks as a young guy in Sydney and involved in boxing, I had Johnny Lewis and the late, great Ray Wheatley, who was my wonderful friend who's just recently passed away. I mean, you couldn't ask for two better friends than those guys for a young guy coming along. And Johnny was able to influence so many people for better. I got a message the other day, and it was Johnny more so than me, but I got a message just out of the blue from a guy called Geordie Peets, who used to be the hooker for Bulldogs, and his son was top player for the rugby league. But he was a young amateur boxer with us in the late 80s, and he had a few fights with Johnny. He was undefeated, if I remember rightly. And he just sent me a message out of the blue saying, oh, I just wanted to send you a note to say how much I appreciated everything you and Johnny did for me in the early days to put me on the right path. And, you know, things like that are... I wouldn't have seen Geordie for 25 years, and yet just for him to remember the fact that, you know, especially... It was Johnny more so than me, put him on a path where he was able to really make something of his life from you know, not a great background, and yet he really made something of himself and had a wonderful family that, you know, he could be proud of.
Mm. Mate, I want to go back to, like, your journalism. So when you left school, you started working at the Telegraph, am I right?
The Brisbane Telegraph,
The Brisbane Telegraph. So were you... Did you study any journalism at school?
No.
Or how did that evolve?
It's funny, I just walked straight into the job from high school. I think they had an intake of about 10 cadets between the Brisbane Telegraph and its sister paper was the morning paper, the Courier Mail, which of course is still going. In those days, you didn't need a degree or anything. I must have just impressed them. I knew a lot about sports and I followed sports and I did some boxing training and whatever, and I just must have impressed the editors at the time that they gave me the job. I think they took on about 10 people in those days. But these days, to get a job in journalism, I think you've got to have a couple of degrees. You know, I used to, at the end of my time at the Courier Mail, I used to see kids coming in with double degrees to get a start to do the same job. I got at 17, they'd be 25 or 26.
So you had no experience and they gave you a job as a journalist or a junior?
Well, no, as a journalist, I started covering stuff straight away, more or less. I suppose I got good marks in English. That was probably the main criteria, I guess. And that I'd read a few papers. I didn't follow the news very closely, not really.
So going through high school, it wasn't, I'm going to be a journalist. It was just get through day by day.
No, well, I was originally going to be a lawyer, you know, like that. That was that was the way I was being guided to, you know, be a lawyer or a barrister. Same thing, but to be a solicitor or a barrister. And I got accepted into Queensland University and into the law school there, but... I was not a wild boy, but I wasn't real big on authority when I was 17 or 18, as a lot of young people are.
That's right.
I was a bit sick of school at the time. You know, wasn't going to be told what to do by anybody in those days. So I got offered the job at the paper, and I thought, well, this is money in my hand straight away. That's what I'll do, rather than another 4 or 5 years study whatever the course was. I can start doing something. And in the end, I was very lucky, and I think a lot of other journalists were a little bit envious. And in the end, I spent about 40 years just talking to my mates and writing stories about what they said. It wasn't all that. I used to have to do some assignments I didn't like, but pretty much it was just going out to see my mates every day and having lunch.
How much was your first weekly wage?
Oh, it wasn't much. It would have probably been about $250, I think. But things were different there. I was telling, you know, like, it's hard for young people to get a start these days. It really is, and I feel for them. And I came along at a time. I remember I went to Sydney, and I was probably on about... When I went to Sydney, I was probably on about 25 grand, I think. I was 19. 19 when I went to Sydney. And I bought my first place the next year, saved up. It was a $3,000 deposit. It was a two-bedroom unit fairly close to the city in Sydney. It was a two-bedroom unit, and I paid $39,000 for it. So it was about a year and a half's wage for a very junior reporter. Mm. Yeah, try doing that now, you know, in Sydney, especially in Brisbane too, but in Sydney's even worse.
Were you a bit surprised when he wasn't following, Grantley wasn't following AFL, Jack, being from Melbourne originally? I thought you might have jumped on that.
Maybe Ballarat, you would have been right into the AFL, but...
Well, I was born only a couple of days, not that we have anything in common, but I was born a couple of days apart from Plugger Lockett in the same hospital. He was a couple of days younger than me. I think older, a couple of days older. Yeah.
Were you into it or just a...
Not really. I remember watching some games...
Don't make them like him anymore, though, just quietly. Jesus.
Yeah, he's a tough guy. I remember watching some AFL with it was called the VFL in those days, with my grandfather. But I played it at school, not very well. I remember I ended up... the coach asked me where I wanted to play, and I thought I wanted to play full forward because that was all the goals. Yeah. But I said to him full back. So the team that I was in,
you would have hated it, mate.
I spent a very, very frustrating season.
The guy that never scores goals.
Never scored a goal.
In the Melbourne Cold. Victoria.
I remember I let a few goals through. I remember.
So where's home to you? Brisbane or Melbourne?
Brisbane.
Sydney, I suppose.
Well, Sydney I lived for 25 years, and Brisbane I've been back here since 2006. So nearly 17 years back. Yeah. I like both. I love living in Sydney. I love the harbour. I go down there all the time, you know, because of the books and launching books and signing books down there and whatever. And I do love it, but I don't love being out. If you've got to travel a long way in Sydney, because it's very frustrating, it's so crowded these days. But I always stay down near the harbour, so it's very nice.
Mate, I'm sure the listeners will want to hear some Jeff Fenwick stories from back in the day, whether it's fights or behind the scenes or whatever. Can you share some light on how things were back in the day?
Well, I remember Jeff was always very... very energetic and very excitable and very volatile. I remember when I first met him, he only had a few amateur fights, but already he had that spark about him that suggested he was going to really go places. And the first time I saw him fight was in the New South Wales Championships, where there was three other guys there that rose to ranks too, the Waters brothers.
Oh, yep.
Troy Guy and Dean Waters, and three of them all became great fighters. They're all competing at the same championships. Jeff, right from the very start, was so aggressive and so physically strong, and wasn't long before, I think I met Jeff in 82, I think he won the Australian title in 83 and went to the Olympics in 84. And I remember Johnny Lewis always says that was his proudest moment in boxing, getting Jeff to the Olympics, because... You know, he was an old school trainer. Johnny in those days was a sign writer for the council, and he trained the boys after work.
Right.
Yeah, I remember they'd start training about 3 o'clock when Johnny finished at the council, maybe 3:30. And so he was very much just a very much a part-time trainer. He trained a couple of professional fighters who came along who come to the police boys club at the same time, like Jeff Malcolm. But I remember Jeff... I was with Jeff all those times. We went up to do all these medical tests together before the Olympics. He was so excited. I remember him having a fight with his mum. Someone from the Olympic committee or someone from the amateur boxing had rung to say that there was a problem and he wasn't going to the Olympics. She'd got the message. She's a little Maltese lady. She got the message all wrong. And he was very, very fired up about that. I think he half destroyed the house.
Oh, jeez.
He was a real live wire. But he went over to the Olympics and he won his first fight, I remember, against an African guy, and then he won the second fight, and then the third fight he lost to a guy. He won the fight. The judges gave him the victory against a guy called Redzep Redzepovsky from Yugoslavia. It was called Yugoslavia in those days. But then, and for whatever reason, in those days, and the same thing happened to another fighter called Renato Cornet there. They had what they called an international jury that would review every decision. And for whatever reason, they voted to overturn the decision that the judges had given to Jeff. And so you can imagine his reaction.
Blow up.
More than a blow up. But anyway, he came back here and he milked that. Like, Jeff was a great self-promoter, and he milked the publicity of being ripped off for that opportunity, that chance to go to the next level where he would have been guaranteed a medal. He milked that for everything and had a great wave of public sympathy. And he turned professional against one of Ray Wheatley's fighters, a guy called Bobby Williams, at the Marrickville RSL, and that became his little base there for a while. And he did that for about a year. He had five or six professional fights. And then one day, I was actually sparring a footballer called Pat Jarvis, who played for Australia.
I know Pat Jarvis. Well, that's Brock's dad, isn't it?
Brock's uncle.
Brock's uncle, sorry.
Yeah.
He played for North Sydney as well?
He played for... Yeah, he might have played... I remember in those days he was playing for the Dragons. He was the Dragons player.
Yeah, I know who he is. Yeah.
He ended up playing for Australia, but he's big... And he's punching... He's battering me, you know, like I was very much a part-time sparrer, very much part-time. But it just happened to be that day, as I was getting smashed all over the place, that Jeff's manager, who was a young lawyer called Colin Love, who did stuff for the Australian Rugby League and ended up the boss of the Australian Rugby League, ended up the chairman of the ARL... He turned up with a former journalist who was a publisher. He published Rugby League magazine. His name was Bill Morty. That was Colin's mate. And they came up to meet Jeff Fenwick and have a chat to him about... They had an idea to promote a fight that they could take the publicity that he'd had for missing out on that medal and expand it. which they did. And Bill promoted a fight at a place called the Horden Pavilion against a little Filipino guy, a tiny little guy, and Jeff battered him and the crowd went mad, and that was really when the legend of Jeff Fenech as a professional fighter really kicked off.
Was Jeff one of the first that Johnny trained from scratch to being a superstar pretty much?
Pretty much. He trained a few fighters along the way, but none sort of reached those heights. And it's interesting the way that things worked out, because Jeff had gone to the gym in 1982, not really interested in boxing. He was a rugby league player, and he coached his little junior team, and he had aspirations to play in what was in the New South Wales Rugby League, but he was a bit small, but very, very light. He was only 55 kilos max, even you know, before he'd come down, he'd fight at 51. So he was very, very small. But he came just to look for someone, and he saw a bloke that he knew sparring, a guy called Mark Cribb, sparring in the gym, and he was just watching him. And Johnny was looking for someone else to spar. He only had one guy, and they were only doing a couple of rounds, and he was looking for someone else. And just out of the background, Johnny hears this kid pipe up, "I'll spar him." And he looked around and said, "Mate, who are you? You know, like, you're supposed to be a proper fighter to have this. You can't just come in off the street and spar this." He says, "No, I'll have a go. And he jumped in and had a go and didn't do all that well. But Johnny looked at him and thought, "Geez, this bloke's a goer, isn't he? Geez, keen." You know, and he from that moment, he said, "Well, mate, why don't you come up tomorrow and start training here, and I'll show you how to box, and I'll show you, you know, the right way to fight. Can you slip a punch? Can you duck? Can you weave? Can you, you know, tie a bloke up?" And he said, "Yeah, all right, I'll come up." So the next day he came up, and within a few weeks, Johnny said, this bloke could be anything. He's just such a talent, such a raw talent. You only have to show him once and he can do it. You know, he can throw every punch. He's as strong as an ox, you know.
Looks like a veteran.
Yeah. And so that's how it started. And before long, a couple of fights, Jeff was the New South Wales champion and then the Australian champion. And after his whole amateur career was 28 fights. And in that time, he'd won a bronze medal at the World Cup. They had a thing called the World Cup in Rome in 83. Yeah. He'd gone to the Commonwealth Championships in Northern Ireland, and then at the Olympics. He'd mowed everyone down. He'd mowed down the three guys. The gold medal, until the decision was overturned and he missed out on the on going to the next level, the bronze medal round. But 2 years later, he fought the Olympic gold medals, who was Steve McCrory, who was a very, very slick boxer, and Jeff just battered him to prove that if he'd been given the chance, he would have won the gold medal, most likely.
I know they went to the same Olympics together, Shane Knox.
Yeah, I knew Shane very well, yeah.
Did they ever fight?
No, they used to spar all the time.
But they were a similar weight, weren't they? Two apart?
Yeah. Shane was a featherweight and Jeff was a flyweight in the amateurs.
Two divisions apart, yeah.
But when they turned professional, and I was in Shane's corner a lot in his career because he trained with Johnny for quite a while. He lived down at Marrickville. Shane used to, they have down in Sydney, and I think they still have them now. What do they call it? Transit lanes. You're only allowed to have one passenger. You're only allowed to, if you've got a passenger, you can drive. Shane used to have a blow-up doll sitting. He used to drive a mini Moke in those days, and he'd be flying along the transit lane with his blow-up doll in the seat next to him.
Noxie had a couple of uses for the blow-up doll.
he was a character. Yeah. But boy, what a puncher. I remember Jeff fought Daniel Zaragoza over in Perth, and we all went over there, and Shane fought on the undercard. Another Mexican, he fought Zaragoza's sparring partner, and battered him. He was very, very, very talented, but he I think he's got to 16-0 and gave it away, but he had the hallmarks of a world champion as well. He probably didn't. I used to talk to Jeff about if he had to fight Shane, and Jeff was always confident that he could beat Shane, you know, if they met at cash weights or whatever. But, you know, if Shane had the same resolve and determination that Jeff had, and the same focus, that absolute steel focus, he probably would have won a world championship as well. He was very, very talented.
Yeah, and had the hammer, didn't he?
Yeah, I called him the hammer. That was my nickname. I called Jeff the Marrickville Mauler.
Did you start that?
That's
you?
Me, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Jeff was the Marrickville Mauler, and I based that off Jack Dempsey, who was the Manassas Mauler, just wearing guys down.
Yeah.
And it was Shane the Hammer Knox, Jeff Hitman Hagen. They're all my nicknames.
So when was your first time in the corner with the professionals there? How did that come about? Johnny just asked you?
Just asked me because, you know, we just sort of clicked. I think he just knew that I was a guy that could be reliable and trustworthy and whatever, and he didn't really have anyone helping him in the gym, and he just sort of asked me to help him out. And I think the first time I went in the corner would have been, I went with Johnny and Jeff Malcolm to Fiji. And Jeff Malcolm had a fight over there. He trained with Johnny for a couple of years amongst about 75 other trainers that he had over the years. Has he been here? Did you train him?
The Flash is the same now. Like, he rings you up when someone's going on and then you don't hear from him for ages.
Yeah. I promoted... the last fight I promoted was Jeff Malcolm against a Filipino called Cisco Farrar. The first fight I promoted was 19... See, I was helping Johnny in the gym and whatever, and Johnny wanted to start promoting fights and managing... He wanted the whole operation and he wanted me to promote the fights for him. So together, I was really the promoter. We promoted Billy Johnstone against...
rugby league player as well?
Great rugby league player. Play for Belmore... not play for Belmore, the Bulldogs, at Belmore Oval, and that's where the fight was.
Yeah. Oh, right.
Against Richie Roberts for the Australian middleweight title. Billy had already had a couple of cracks at Australian titles and had lost. He fought Ken Salisbury, I remember, who was a very good boxer and a really good guy. This was 1984, I think, early 1984, February 1984, at Belmore Sports Ground. Billy Johnstone against Richie Roberts. And I tell you, I was telling someone this the other day after Ray's passing, we were reminiscing because my friend Ray Wheatley had a fighter on the undercard, a four-round fighter. And I was doling out the cash after it. The payment for a four-round fight in those days was generally $80. Right. You know, people were keen in those days to fight. Yeah. And but Ray was a hard negotiator, and I ended up stumping up 100. He said, "Oh, come on, it was a good fight. Can you make it 100?" I said, "Oh, all right, $100." You know, I think they get a bit paid a bit more than these days. And I remember Billy Johnson was hard as nails. It was in the blazing outdoor sun. At Belmore Sports Ground in the summer, you know, we didn't really think much in those days about health and safety. And for 11 rounds, Billy just battered Richie Roberts, who was the middleweight champ, just battered him. But in the 12th round, he went cuckoo. I don't know if the sun got to him or whatever happened to him, just the aggression just boiled over. And he went cuckoo and he charged from his corner with his head down, just like a bull, and battered Richie Roberts. And Richie Roberts, that was his moment to shine. He'd lost every round. He flopped on the canvas like he was dead. And the referee, who was Billy Males, who'd been a very good amateur fighter himself, Billy Males, he had no option but to disqualify him. So in his third try at the Australian middleweight title, after winning nearly every round, Billy Johnson was disqualified. And he was absolutely gutted. You know, like, I don't know if you've ever met Billy, but he's as hard as nails. He's like from Cunnamulla. He's just a really, really tough man. And he was crying his eyes out in the dressing room. And his purse was supposed to be $3,000 for 12 rounds in the blazing sun, but I ended up giving him $3,500, I remember. And
Felt sorry for him.
it was heartbreaking for us because I knew how hard Billy had trained in the gym getting ready for the fight. And like, he really put every ounce of determination he had into it, and for whatever reason, just went mad in the last round.
Have you heard of Billy Johnson, Jack?
No, I can't get my head around Grantley's memory. I can't remember what I did yesterday. Mate, the fact you can recite so many things and who was there and how their careers were, that's unreal.
Billy made a career after rugby league as the hard man trainer. He was training the Cowboys and other teams, and, you know, like, it was the old school methods. If you don't vomit on your run, you know you're not trying hard enough.
That's what I was going to bring up because the rugby league players that you speak to say he was brutal.
Oh, he was brutal. Yeah. Well, another.
I think he went with the Kangaroos too, didn't he? Once.
Yeah. He was. Johnny Lewis was a Kangaroos trainer. He might have been training the Kangaroos. He didn't play for Australia.
Yeah.
But another guy with that same sort of mentality was Tommy Rodonicus. He trained with us for a little while because he had a football in the early days. You didn't see footballers fighting too often, not like today. Mm. But he had a grudge fight with his great rival Greg Oliphant, and he trained up with Johnny, and he'd be there doing the patch and chundering at the same time. Not very pleasant.
Having a durry halfway through the round.
It seems like all the boys back then could fight, though, couldn't they?
Yeah.
Well, I've even seen old videos of, you know, Gary Ablett Sr., of him boxing people in Pentridge.
Lester Ellis.
Yeah.
He was a goer. And not long after that, like, Tommy had the footballer fight and was training with us. He and his mate John Singleton, who's a very rich advertising executive down there, they decided they'd going to promote a show at the Sydney Opera House. Mm. And it was the only time they've ever had boxing there, and ended up an all-in brawl. It was a guy called Ken Salisbury, who was the Australian junior middleweight champ, fighting a very volatile fighter called Alex Temelkov from Wollongong. And Temelkov's Ken Salisbury was trained by a guy called Bernie Hall, who was rather eccentric. He was a very good boxer in his heydays. He'd fought the great Freddie Dawson back in the 40s, but he had a big mane of blonde hair, and you can still see the footage on YouTube. But Alex Temelkov was hitting Ken Salisbury low, and Ken Salisbury's trainer, Bernie Hall, jumped in and got him in a headlock, and that sparked the Temelkov camp to all run in with karate kicks, and all the kung fu was all the rage in those times, and doing all these karate kicks. And the referee was Sharky Raymond, real name Dave Ballard, but he was as tough as nails. He was the Australian, he was the world number one junior middleweight in the early 70s, and he was the referee, and one of them king hit Sharky, so it was on. The referee was punching on with the corners. Oh. Yeah.
Yeah, mate.
You can see that footage on YouTube.
Yeah, I think I have seen that.
The Sydney Opera House. I'd only been in Sydney a little while then. It was the last time they had boxing there. Yeah.
Yeah, well, we've got a guy that trains at the gym. His name is Josh Doo, Ronald Doo's son. So he would have been in the Festival Hall days when you spent time there. And I remember researching, having a look at Ronald's record. In his first year of professional boxing, he had 23 fights.
Yeah, yeah. Like, over the day.
These guys don't have 23 in their careers now.
Yeah, incredible, isn't it?
Well, how many did Jeff end up with?
Jeff Fenwick
was an era where they had a lot of fights.
Probably no more than 20.
Yeah. And Ronald Doo had 23 in one year.
First year. Mm. I remember Ronald Doo well. I was in the corner for Jeff Malcolm. He beat Ronald Doo at the State Sports Centre, I think, at Homebush, just before the Olympics, or around the time of the Olympics, yeah. Yeah, he was a good fighter, Ronald Doo, yeah.
What's your best moment in the corner? One that stands out at head and shoulders above the rest?
Well, you know, like seeing Jeff Fenwick win the world title to beat a guy called Satoshi Shingaki for the first fight, that was tremendous. And then
that was his first world title?
First world title. Win. He'd only been a pro for a year.
Yeah.
I was in his corner for all his world title wins. And then he became the first Australian to win two world titles. He fought a really, really good fighter from Thailand. He'd been a great kickboxer called Samart Pakaroon. But a real cool dude. He was like the Thailand's number one playboy. He was a real slinky joker. And I remember a couple of nights before the fight, I knew he was eating at a Thai restaurant up in the middle of Sydney there, up in Oxford Street. So I went up to get some photos of him. And like he had a big fight coming up. He's got a durry hanging from his bottom lip, and he's cooking his stir fry himself on the side, you know, with a couple of Thai girls waiting at the table.
Yeah, for
him. He's a real slick guy. He went back and ended up as a bit of a pop star over there, but he was a slick dude. But he was a great fighter, big heavy puncher, big southpaw. And he dropped Jeff in the first round, and we all had our hearts in the mouth. But Jeff was just relentless pressure. Mm. And Pakaroon, even though he'd had so many kickboxing fights and hard professional fights, he just couldn't cope with the pressure, and Jeff just overwhelmed him. Yeah. And poor old Pakaroon, it was the days where, you know, big gambling and whatever. His managers had put all his money, so they said, on his victory. It was about $175,000 US, which was pretty big money in the mid-80s. And when Pakaroon got back home, everyone was just staggered that he'd lost. And the crowds, you know, waiting for him at the airport, you know, abusing him, and people who'd lost all their money backing him because he was such an idol over there. He had to do the usual penance and shave his head and go into a monastery for a while. He was a monk over there for a while to hide out until a furor died down.
Geez, I'm sure you would have seen some crazy stories of opponents and I suppose having Jeff and Jeff Harding. Mate, I wouldn't mind knowing a bit more about Jeff Harding's fighting career because you were in his corner.
Yep.
Were you in his corner for the big one, Dennis Andres?
No, I was actually covering that for newspapers and magazine, Penthouse magazine in those days, which was one of the few avenues that used to run really big feature stories. It was almost like a book I wrote on the fight, sort of following the tradition of Norman Mailer writing big magazine stories about the fight. But the promoter was it was a really weird time. It was over in Atlantic City, and I remember the promoter at the time, it was a co-promotion between Bob Arum and a big shifty real estate spiv over there that everyone thought was as dodgy as anything, and it was Donald Trump. Yeah, it's quite extraordinary. He ended up the President of the United States.
That's right.
In those days, you'd see him like in the foyer with a couple of other spivs, you know, like he was just regarded as this big shonky spruiker, you know, bloke that would talk up all his real estate enterprises. And
so he was boxing through and through.
Yeah, so he fitted right in. And he ran all the big, well, a lot of the big casinos there. They were all, I remember there was the Trump Taj Mahal, there was Trump Tower, the Trump Plaza. There were all these big casinos, and the Harding fight was. It was really an interesting fight. Jeff Harding and Johnny Lewis were at loggerheads at the time, and they ended up splitting apart. You know, there's always lots of frictions and rivalries in boxing, and I think Jeff Harding was very envious of the time that Johnny Lewis was spending with Jeff Fenwick. It was one of those situations, right. You know, like, yeah. You don't love me as much, so I'm going to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
But when they went over there, Jeff Harding only got the opportunity because Donnie Lalonde was supposed to fight Dennis Andres but got injured and had to pull out. And Jeff Harding, even though he was undefeated, no one really knew who he was. In fact, Dennis Andres at the press conference thought he was fighting Jess Harding, who was a British cruiserweight.
Or his sister.
Yeah. No, there was a cruiserweight in Britain called Jess Harding, and that's who he thought he was fighting. Wow. Jess Harding. And they said, no, it's Jeff Harding.
So he hadn't really done his homework.
Not really. The fight was pretty one-sided until late in the stage. Dennis Andres punched the crap out of Jeff Harding. He really did. He busted up his nose and had him down, and had him badly hurt. But Jeff Harding was like you just programmed him. Johnny Lewis would get in his ear and just program, and he'd just keep going boom, 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 boom. Mm. And that's after 11 rounds of that, Dennis Andres. He'd hit Jeff Harding with everything, and he was still there. And I think it broke his heart a little bit. In his corner, you know, Johnny was very Shakespearean. Johnny Lewis, like, he gave Jeff Harding the best wind up of all time. He said, "Son, go out there and give it everything you've got. Come back a world champion, mate. You can do it. He's tired. He's more tired than you." That's why he used to talk. He's more tired than you. You think you're buggered? He's more buggered than you. Get out there and come back as world champion. And Jeff Hardy got up and Dennis Andres in his corner, they said, "Oh, you know, it's close." Andres on the scorecards has won just about every round. He was a mile in front. He could have run away for the three and still been world champion. So Dennis Andres has come out to knock out Harding, and Harding's there waiting for him. And they just went at it for about 2 minutes. And then finally, Andres, he was exhausted. And Andres, his composure just cracked, and Harding just jumped on him and just kept battering and battering and battering. And it was one of the great Rocky moments of all time. And unfortunately, that was the, it was sort of almost like the open gate for Jeff Harding's life for a long time to go off the rails. The success sort of went to his head a little bit, and he didn't know really how to handle it. And he ended up losing the title back to Andres. He won it back again. But he just didn't have the focus and the anchor in his life that someone like a Jeff Fenwick had. He didn't have the street smarts, and he fell on hard times for quite a while, sleeping rough, and ended up in jail for a little while. You know, his drinking got out of control, and it was, I guess, one of my proudest moments. He and I were at loggerheads for a long time, Jeff Harding, but he. I saw him in 2013 at the Australian Boxing Hall of Fame, and he told me that he wasn't drinking anymore. And seemed, I remember he was there with Lionel Rose's widow, and it just seemed like he'd found a place in his life. I think that he finally had admitted his faults and overcome the demons in many ways.
It's hard to do for anyone, I suppose.
It is hard, and it's always baffled me. You know, like a guy that could be so focused and so strong, and mentally so tough and physically so tough, in other ways could be weak and let addictions and things get on top of him, because he went through a very bad time for a long time and hurt a lot of the people who were trying to help him.
Grantley, with you reporting and being like good mates with a lot of the athletes, did you ever have any run-ins when you did write articles?
Well, it's funny you say that, because you know, like Jeff Fenwick and I, we didn't talk for a long time. We became no speakies for a long time because of the way that I would cover the fight. You know, like I always try to the best of my ability, to be honest about fights and whatever. And often I would write things that even my friends didn't like. You know, because I was trying to, I felt I had a duty to the readership and the sporting public to tell the truth. You know, if I thought someone had performed badly, or if I thought their opponents were very ordinary, you know, there's always a talk of, you know, people bringing in Thai taxi drivers for people to fight. And if I said that some opponents were very very ordinary. You know, a lot of people didn't like that. I've made lots of enemies over the years in covering boxing, but that's the way, so be it. Mm.
I remember, well, more recently, back in the day, so I was working on construction and Trad McLean was the... it was working for the Bulletin and you were working for the Courier Mail.
Okay.
It was like... I remember myself and Chris McCullen used to buy both newspapers, the Courier Mail, when there was Anthony Mundine fights coming up, and it seemed like Trad was the positive and you were the negative on Chock. It was like, I don't know if anybody else saw it, but we used to buy both papers because we were just boxing mad.
Yeah.
We'd buy both and it was like, Granley's hammering Chock, Trad loves him, what's going on here?
Yeah.
How did I suppose you were good friends with Tony.
Well,
how did that, you were there a part of that evolving of Anthony Mundine's career, a part of it, I suppose.
Yeah, well, I didn't get on with Anthony for a long time. He called me the spit bucket boy once, which incensed Johnny. Johnny says, "You're never spit bucket." I don't mind. But you know, like a lot of his opponents, I thought in the early days were pretty ordinary, and I thought he was extremely arrogant. And he, of course, was doing it to whip up the public as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, I thought a lot of the things that he said were uncalled for, you know, attacking people and the legends of the rugby league and whatever, and always playing the racism card. I thought that was very uncalled for, you know, saying that, you know, the reason he couldn't get a go was for racism. Well, there seems to be plenty of Aboriginal players that did get a go, you know, so... And then he said, oh, it's because I'm outspoken. Well, you know, maybe the other players they picked were actually better than you, you know. Maybe you just don't see it that way. So we didn't get on for a long time, but we ended up quite... you know, getting on quite well, and I had enormous respect for his talents, incredible respect. My mate Ray Wheatley virtually secured his IBF fight against Sven Otke over in Germany, and you know, that was a surprise. I didn't think he'd go as well as he did. For the first six rounds, he was giving Otke a boxing lesson. Otke was a tremendous boxer, a great boxer, who said not that long ago that Mundine was the best opponent he ever fought, and he fought lots of good fighters.
He did. Yeah. I've heard the same too.
Yeah, yeah. He said that Mundine was the fastest, the most talented person that he'd faced, which was a huge compliment because he fought great fighters, Otke.
To fight for a world title in was it 10th fight or was it his 11th? Yeah,
10th, I think. Yeah, or after 10 fights, whatever it was. Anyway, we were over there in Dortmund, and I remember I sat next to Sam Solomon, who pushed Anthony pretty closely in the first fight, and. I sat next to Sam right on the ring apron, and on the other side was a guy called Mickey Van, who's a leading referee
British.
In England.
Referee.
And after sixth round, Mickey Van says, "Looks like your boy's going to get it." I said, "He's not my boy."
I like his dad.
And then I guess common sense prevailed in the end because Anthony fought well above himself, but the pace of it, he wasn't used to that sort of pace.
Yeah.
And Otke was very, very clever.
Oh, very...
Yeah.
Military, European-style high hands.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you mentioned Mickey Van, though, Mickey Van was the referee that kicked the towel out when Mick Katsidis fought Graham Earl.
Yeah, yeah,
Did you cover that fight?
I didn't cover that one, no, but I remember it. Yeah, he's very old school. I don't know if Mickey would like it if someone did that to him.
No, definitely. Yeah. And we actually had him when I took Paddy Murphy over to Ireland. He was the referee for that fight against... Peter McDonough, I've met him before, but yeah, when he kicked that towel out against Mick Katsidis, that was crazy bizarre. To think that would happen.
Bizarre. You know, like, I asked Tony who'd win if they'd fought him and his son at their best.
Wow.
Tony, of course, thought he'd win. But he, as he said, you know, my boy's a very talented boxer, very good, he said, but he was blessed that he came along in an era where there were four world champs for a start, and also that there was a super middleweight division. Tony was a light heavyweight who had to fight as a middleweight because he had to boil down. They made him fight as a middleweight, so a lot of his fights he went in very, very weak in Tony. But as he said, I was a better puncher than Anthony. He said, when I used to hit him, that was it, lights out. Yeah.
During your time with Anthony and Tony and... not really get along with Anthony, did you still have a friendly relationship with Tony Mundine?
I would see him, and he was always respectful. I found him a real great gentleman of the sport, Tony, and I found him an inspiration too. You know, he's 70 years old or even more now.
Yeah.
Or he's around 70 years. Or was he born in 1950, I think, 52. And the guy's still super fit. He's and he puts that down just to clean living, no drugs, no drinking, you know, just looking after himself and doing exercise every day, which is terrific. I was actually in his corner once against a guy called... And summed up sort of Tony's career. It was at Festival Hall against a guy called Murray Sutherland, who was the world super middleweight champion and who fought a lot of good light heavyweights in the early 80s. And Sutherland, if you looked at him, Mundine was an Adonis. You know, Tony was an Adonis, super fit, and always in great shape. And Murray Sutherland was like a bag of bones, just a real skinny, scrawny guy. He was Scottish, but he lived in Detroit. He was living in America. But when the fight started, like Tony started real fast, you know, real fast hands and moving and like super slick. But Murray Sutherland just stayed on and was tough as nails and rode out his best shots. And Tony, I think, was a guy, I think he was one of our greatest fighters, but he was very much a confidence man. And you see that with fighters, I think, say a fighter like Michael Zarafa, I've sort of seen that too. If you can break their confidence early, they go into a shell and they're nowhere near as effective. And I think that was the thing with Tony. You know, if you could get on top of him early, all that brilliance would go away. And in that fight, Murray Sutherland dominated for almost all the fight against a boxer who was technically and skillfully much, much better than him. But Sutherland got the decision.
I've heard people say, you know, and look, it's negative people, it's not positive people, that say Tony Mundine had a glass jaw.
Yeah.
But then I've heard other people say, if anyone got hit by those punches that he got,
that's
they
right.
all had a glass jaw.
Yeah, that's right. They early in his career, even my mate Ray Wheatley dropped Tony in 1969 at a fight at Manly. But the most famous one was in the TV ringside where boxing was very, very popular. So much of the country would have seen it. He fought another hot prospect. This is in the late 60s, called Kahu Mahunga.
Oh, yeah.
Kahu Mahunga was a big, big puncher. And he hit Mundine flush and knocked him out. And from that moment, he had the tag that he had a glass jaw. But as people say, if Kahu Mahunga hit just about any fighter in the world with that punch, he would have knocked them out, you know. So it's no disgrace there. And Tony beat a lot of big punches and managed to get away with them. So he was, you know, he was a very, very good fighter. Beat Emil Griffith and, yeah, he was a terrific fighter.
Can't imagine the gloves back then being very protective either.
And, you know, the calibre of opponents that he fought some of the best middleweights in the world over quite an extended period. And then he ended up almost winning a shot at the world cruiserweight title. He fought the Olympic gold medalist called Matei Pavlov in about 1980, I think. And Pavlov was a big guy, you know, 85 kilos or whatever. And Mundine was, he'd started out as a middleweight. And Pavlov hit him with plenty of shots, and Tony was still there at the end. So, I don't, whether he had a glass jaw or not, he certainly rode lots of big shots during his career.
And I want to talk about your journalism now. Nowadays, obviously, the landscape's changing, just like the boxing world.
Yeah.
Back then, the way you would have wrote, it was all about newspaper. Would you write that night and it'd come out the next day or two days later? Or
Well, it's all. Towards the end there, the last few years of my career, it was totally different. You were writing for the websites. It was like constantly on the go and having to update web.
It's got to be instant too, because that's what people need now.
Whereas when I started out, you know, you could take all day to write a nice big feature story about a fight. But now, everything's instantaneous and everything. And I think the magic of the journalism gets lost there. And there's a lot of misinformation. You know, I remember. When Jeff Horn was fighting Terence Crawford, he missed the weight the first time on the scales. I'm getting messages on my phone. We need the Jeff Horn story urgent. It looks like he's going to lose his world title, you know, because he's missed the weight one go. Mm. And I'm sort of sending back, no, he'll come back in half an hour and be on the weight, everything. But back at the office, they don't know that. They're just saying, oh, you know, because someone on social media said, it looks like he's going to lose his world title. So a lot of the magic and a lot of the expertise, I think, in that sort of sports journalism has been lost because of social media.
Yeah, it's a different... Everyone thinks they're a journalist nowadays.
Yeah, that's
they?
Right. Everyone's a... and social media gives everyone a megaphone, don't they? And there is a lot of misinformation in there. I remember when I went over to... you know, things were totally different. In 1987, I went over to England with Joe Bugner for his fight with Frank Bruno, and I saw another side of the journalism over there. Joe was being hunted for alimony by his first wife, and we're at the weigh-in, and there's a guy there with a papers trying to serve him, and Joe jump on the scales and then sneak out the side door. That was and all around the hotel were all these Fleet Street, you know, the red yep. tops they call them over there, all the scandal sheets in England, all trying to get some sort of sleazy scoop on Joe. That was an education.
Geez, the tabloids over there are brutal, aren't they?
Oh, they are.
The
yeah.
The Sun, the you know, like. Yeah. They just print whatever's a good story. Like, there's not much truth in it.
He told me in 1975 he fought Muhammad Ali in Kuala Lumpur for the world heavyweight title. And it was like 100 degrees over there, terrible heat and whatever. And he lost on points. You know, Ali was too good for him the second time especially. They'd had a closer fight the first time they fought. But he said that after the fight, some of the journalists and photographers, they asked him to pose in the swimming pool with a cocktail to... you know, show how hot it was and that he was finally able to relax after the fight. And he said the next day all the stories were about how he'd only gone there for a holiday and hadn't even tried. Oh, and he said, wow. They just set me up. They set me up with this cocktail in the swimming pool. Oh. He said, I was bloody exhausted. I went 15 rounds with Muhammad Ali in 100 degree heat. But, yeah, Joe didn't have a great opinion of a lot of the Fleet Street writers. Yeah.
Brutal. So, Frank Bruno, yeah, Mate, he's somebody I watched quite a bit when I was younger.
Yeah.
When Bugner fought Bruno, where was that?
And it was at White Hart Lane in London.
Tottenham Hotspurs. And what sort of crowd are we talking?
It was nearly 40,000. I think it was about 38,000. I remember, that was, you were talking about great memories from being in the corner. That was probably, as far as an event, probably the best event that I was involved in, being in the corner. There was such a huge crowd there.
Frank Maloney, promoter?
Barry Hearn.
Barry Hearn promoted that.
Eddie Hearn's father. He'd made his career in snooker.
Yes.
And he used to always tell a funny story, Barry. At the time, Frank Bruno was the great hero in England. He was undefeated in British boxing. He was a real rising heavyweight contender, and they had never had a world heavyweight champion. And at the same time, Joe was making a comeback. Joe had a pretty lavish sort of lifestyle and he needed money for a comeback. So he made a comeback in 1986, training with Johnny Lewis in Newtown because of the success Jeff Fenwick was having. So Johnny got to train Joe Bugner. So Joe's making a bit of a name for himself in Sydney. He's fought a couple of good fighters. They brought out James Tillis, who was the first guy to go the distance with Mike Tyson.
Yep.
Joe beat him pretty easy. Then they brought out David Bay, who just fought Larry Holmes for the world heavyweight title, gone 10 or 11 rounds. And then they brought out Greg Page, the former WBC World Heavyweight Champion, who was trained by a guy called Richie Giacchetti, who also trained Larry Holmes. And I didn't know at the time, but he was like a mafia enforcer. They call his nickname on the streets was Ricky the Torch, because he'd burn your house down if you didn't pay up. it was bizarre. And I'm in the, like I say, I was a few years before just a shy boy from Brisbane, schoolboy. And I'm in the ring, you know, having a fight with this guy in the centre ring saying,
Yeah.
It's quite weird, you know. So Joe had won these fights. Barry Hearn has made his name in snooker, has made quite a fortune in snooker over in England. And he's in the Chinese restaurant in London one time with his wife, and he's saying to her, look, I really want to promote a fight. We've got Frank Bruno here. We could, and he wasn't Bruno's manager or promoter or whatever. He just had this idea. He said, I reckon that we put the great England hero against the villain, because years before, Joe Bugner had beaten Henry Cooper, and who was a great hero in England, and was now regarded as forevermore as the villain, because he almost like shot Bambi, you know, like he'd beaten England's great hero. I reckon if we put the hero, Frank Bruno, against the villain, Joe Bugner, it'll be the biggest fight ever in Britain. And he says, I reckon I can do it. I've got the experience promoting snooker. I reckon I can do it. And his wife laughed at him and said, there's no way you could do anything like that. You know, just stick to the snooker. So he had Joe's phone number, and he got in those days you didn't have mobile phones, he got the Chinese restaurant to bring a phone to his table, and he rang Joe up at his house, at his flat where he used to live there in Darling Point in Sydney. And he said, Joe, my name is Barry Hearn, and I want to promote a fight with you against Frank Bruno outdoors in London this year. And Joe's got quite a high voice. He says, that would take a very lot of money, Barry. I'm not interested whatsoever. and Barry Hearn said, I'll give you £250,000, Joe. And Joe, quick as a flash, said, what plane would you like me on, Barry? So from that moment, and that was only about 5 or 6 weeks, I think, before the fight. So Joe, who hadn't been training, he'd beaten Greg Page, hadn't been training. So suddenly he's got this fight offer, the biggest purse of his career, in the £250,000 in those days. The Australian dollar, with the exchange rate, it was worth about $750,000. This is 1987. And even though he'd fought Ali twice, he hadn't got a purse that big in his career. So he took the fight, even though he had limited time. He really, in the end, only had about 3.5 weeks to get ready for the fight. And Johnny Lewis and I had to stay in Sydney because Jeff was fighting a guy called Carlos Zarate, former world bantamweight champ, which Jeff won. And then we headed to London after that, about 7 days before the fight, I think. So Joe was training with another guy from our gym, Brian Wilmot, who's quite famous now as a cut man. So he went over with Joe about 3 weeks before the fight. And it was a huge, huge event. It was outdoor arena, Tottenham Hotspur's ground, White Hart Lane. And Joe played it up for everything he could, you know. And Barry Hearn was grateful like anything because Frank Bruner's quite a dour sort of slow-speaking. Joe was hammering it up, the big villain. He was wearing the big Crocodile Dundee hat around and showing the big Aussie Joe. Yeah, big Aussie Joe, all that, And he was really, really playing up. I remember he's got a high voice. He was saying at the press conference, he says, "Joe Pugner is not here to dilly or to dally. He is going to give this young upstart a good hiding." And he was fired up, Joe. But we suspected, like, we didn't see him training for the 3 weeks beforehand. We suspect that he wasn't training all that hard because no one had ever seen him go for a run the whole time he was in London. And he went to the gym. He sparred a couple of good fighters down there, but he just didn't have the time to get ready. And it's the only time, I remember it vividly, because the only time in my life that anything like this would ever happen to me or even the guys that we were with, the night of the fight, the afternoon of the fight, they had two big stretch Bentleys, those big old sort of Bentleys that the Queen used to drive in, S1 Bentleys, I think, waiting for us. So we got in the cars at our hotel. It was just near Euston Station, I remember. It was called the White Hart Hotel, I think. We got in with bodyguards and whatever, and they had a police escort at the front, a guy on a motorbike, and one behind us. And we cut through the traffic. They were stopping the traffic for us to get through because it was such a big event. You know, the traffic in London is really, really intense. So we could get there, and there was... The two Bentley limousines with the police escort. And it took us still about an hour to get through there, but they were stopping the traffic so we could get through. And when we got there, Joe was still very much the villain. He had his Australian tracksuit on and, you know, like all the Australian flags and whatever he's like. He gets out of the thing and they're all booing, "Get back to Australia!" You know, the big crowd there booing him. Anyway, we go to the dressing room to get ready, and they got me to go and check on Frank Bruno's gloves, his hand taping and whatever. And Frank Bruno had this image of this big, happy, affable, sort of fun-loving guy. It was the darkest, most intense dressing room I've ever been in, and he was there ready to kill. He had his and he's banging them against the wall, like, boom, boom, like this, you know, smashing it. And he was ready to kill. I was quite intimidated, but it took me really by surprise because every time I'd encountered him, he'd been this big happy guy. And in Joe's dressing room, he's got all these Australians. So he's playing up the Aussie Joe. He's got Waltzing Matilda playing and all this sort of stuff. And Barry Hearn came down to the dressing room to see if everything was okay. And he goes into Frank Bruno's room, and almost like a morgue. They're all sour and all intense. He goes into Joe's room. There's Waltzing Matilda and Click Go the Shears playing. And Joe's holding... Oh, sorry. I've just knocked the microphone. Joe's holding up two dressing grounds. You know, one's got a waffle motif and one's got some other sort of green and gold thing. He's saying to his wife, "Darling, which of these dressing grounds do you think I look best in?" You know? And he couldn't believe it. So anyway, the fight starts. So we go out into the huge stadium. It's like... The boos for Joe, it's like a jet engine taking off, as he comes out, and he's got this robe on designed by this very flamboyant dress designer in Sydney, all beautiful wattle motifs all over it and sort of like a beautiful stitching and whatever. And he goes out there and they're just booing and throwing things at him. And the joint was so crowded, I had to climb into the ring. The actor Bruce Willis and his wife at the time, Demi Moore, there at ringside. We had to virtually climb over them to get into the ring. Wow. And it was the most supercharged atmosphere I've ever seen. Even though I'd been involved with Jeff Fenwick and Jeff Harding, the atmosphere there was just absolutely electric. And when the fight started, like Joe was doing his... Joe came out to do his best. He thought that he could beat, even with limited preparation, they could beat Frank Bruno. But it wasn't to be. He gave a good fight, I guess, for about the first five or six rounds, but Bruno was just too... Bruno at the time was 25 and absolute peak physical condition, and Joe was 37 and down on condition. But Joe still gave a good fight until finally. And I think the eighth round, Bruno nailed Joe with a big right hand, and as even though he's 37 and at the end of his career at the very top, Joe still refused to go down. He sort of sat on the bottom rope, and I remember vividly Frank Bruno leapt up like it was like he was trying to drive in a fence post and started smashing Joe on top of the head, trying to drive him through the canvas.
Yeah, right.
And Johnny ended up throwing in the towel. But at the time, I remember this vividly too. Johnny was losing his hair at the time. He used to have a full head of hair and a beard when I met him. That's why I always say when he started training Jeff Fenwick, his hair started tearing his hair out. But Johnny was very paranoid about hair loss at this time. And he's like examining everyone, you know, on the plane. He'd be, you know, checking our scalps and whatever. So he said to me one time, he said, "Mate, you ever thought of combing your hair over that way?" You know, and I said, "Oh, whatever." And I remember even much worse than the pain that Frank Bruno had inflicted on Joe, Johnny says after the fight, he says, Frank was just too young, too strong, too mobile. He says, "I tell you another thing too about Joe, he's getting very thin on top."
Jeez, I wouldn't have thought Johnny Lewis would be like that. That worried about it. That's new news to me.
He was very worried about hair loss, yeah. But he learned to accept it over time.
Well, you just have to, don't you?
Yeah.
We all go there eventually. You know, Jack's going there before me.
I'm going grey, and that is from you.
But I tell you, I was so lucky. I did an interview with a fight news a little while. You know, my friend Ray Wheatley was always doing great things to help me. Always, you know, ever since I met him 40 something years ago. And one of the last things he did for me, he did a big interview on my involvement in boxing for Fight News, which he wrote for. And I said in the interview that meeting Johnny Lewis is probably one of the, well, definitely one of the very, if not the best things that ever happened to me. Because, you know, as a young boy when I went down to Sydney, I didn't really know anyone. Johnny introduced me to a whole world of, he introduced me to a great sporting community and really furthered my, not just my career as a journalist, but as a human being. And then he showed me, you know, what you can do with determination and commitment and dedication, because that's what he brought to all his fighters, you know, and a sense of humour as well. You know, like Johnny made training up there for those guys. He really, really turned their lives around. Who knows what would have happened to Jeff Fenwick if he hadn't met Johnny Lewis? He'd have probably been successful in some field, but it was Johnny that brought out that talent and made him focused and made him so physically strong and so determined to achieve.
Right. Can you tell us, I know you spent a lot of time in the Philippines before Jeff Horn fought.
Yeah.
And I think we spoke a few times and it's like everyone at the time, man, this can't really happen, can it? Can they really make this fight, Jeff Horn versus Manny Pacquiao? I remember Jeff saying to me, and we said this when Jeff's podcast the other week, Jeff said to me, he said, you didn't think I'd win, did you? I saw him a few weeks after the fight and I went, Jeff, I was hoping you would, but you were fighting Manny Pacquiao,
yeah,
mate.
Yeah,
but you were one of the only guys you tipped it maybe 6 weeks out.
Yep.
Give us a bit of why you thought Jeff was going to beat Manny Pacquiao.
And it's funny because just the night before, I think Ray Wheatley did an interview with me for Fight News, a video interview, and I tipped Jeff to win there too. You know, I went over to the Philippines. I think the fight was in July the 2nd, and I think we went to the Philippines in February, and we were there for about a week or 10 days from memory, watching Manny Pacquiao train, and went to his house and went out for dinner with him. He was a lovely guy, you know, just an absolute gent considering where he is on the world stage. But I just had the feeling watching him training. I'm not saying he didn't take it 100%, but he trained with just a fraction of the intensity that Jeff Horn was training. You know, like he'd spend hours in the gym, but half of it was like stopping training and have a chat with someone. You know, like he'd be doing the pads, he'd do a couple of rounds on the pads, then he'd stop and have a chat, and and just sort of wander around the gym for a while. And the stuff that he was doing was intense, you know, like he's doing calisthenic kind of exercises and jumping exercises, and then he'd be hitting the speedball for a while and it looked fantastic. But the way that Jeff Horn was training with Glenn Rushton and with Dundee Kim, it was full on, really, really focused and determined, and you could just see the hunger in Jeff Horn's, just in the way that he was approaching the fight was totally different to the way that Manny Pacquiao was doing it. And then then he started sparring with Cesaro Monzon, and he looked dynamic. I know Monzon was probably past his best as a fighter, but he just looked dynamic, Jeff Horn. I thought the Manny Pacquiao that I saw over in Manila is not going to be able to handle the pace of the Jeff Horn that I'm seeing fighting, training at Stretton, and that's the way it proved to be. You know, people say it was, you know, a lot of the Americans said, oh, it was a rort and that Manny Pacquiao won the fight. I didn't think so. You know, like after eight rounds, I remember saying, Pacquiao can't win this. I was sitting next to Jeff's granddad right on the ring apron. I was sort of, he was very deaf and had poor eyesight, so I was his sort of eyes and ears at ringside. And after every round, I was saying, yep, that's another good round. I remember the ninth round, though, he was saying, how's he going? I said, oh, he's got a lot of rounds in the bank. That was very touch and go that round, but he managed to get through it and won the fight. I thought he won fair and square. I didn't think that there was any doubt whatsoever.
No, I agree. We both have our moments, have our recollection of that night. I remember being stood next to Chris McCullen, metres from the ringside, because I had Damien Hooper
That's
fighting
right,
earlier
yeah.
on. So we were, you know, roaming around, and it was again about after the eight, and I said to Chrissy, he's going to win this.
Yeah.
And we were like, this can't happen. Yeah. And then, yeah, but you've got your own, you know, you remember as well, Jack.
Yeah,
that
I remember
moment.
While I was at home watching it with my parents and exactly the same feelings. I think it was after about eight. Yep, well, he's going to win this. As long as he doesn't do anything stupid. And then the ninth happened and I was like, just hang in. And then I thought I had it like 8-4 or somewhere about that. But man, that was a massive moment. And it's cool to have him on, and everyone's got their memory of what happened that day. It's cool.
It's amazing, isn't it? You know, like when it was happening and when the fight was over, we were sort of looking at each other saying, is this really happening?
Yeah.
You know, it was almost like a dream. The whole afternoon was, did this really just happen? You know, I remember I got into the ring with Jeff Fenwick, you know, because he went over to Manny because he'd had dealings with Manny in the past, and Jeff said, oh, you know, bad luck, mate, you know, like, and we went over to Jeff Horn. It was almost like Alice in Wonderland stuff, you know, this kid that didn't even really like fighting and still doesn't really like fighting, you know, still doesn't like getting hit or hitting people and whatever, just beat Manny Pacquiao, you know, the guy that we'd seen bowl over everybody, Ricky Hatton and Oscar De La Hoya, all those people, you know.
The Jeff Horn story is crazy, man. It's crazy. For him, like, just going up to the Mansfield Tavern, watching the Australian Championships, going, oh, yeah, I can beat this guy. And like he said, that was my thought, but I knew I know I couldn't at the time. Yeah. But he said, like, but the self-belief, and that's where Jeff and Glenn worked together, you know what I mean? They worked with Glenn's
mental
force of that mental that mental strength against Jeff, and Jeff just bought into it. It was what a partnership.
A lot of people, and there's a lot of jealousy in boxing, of course, and people bag Glenn Rushton and his training methods, and they say, oh, you know, he holds the pads all funny and whatever. But as I say, only he could have done what he did with Jeff Horn, you know.
Exactly.
He got in the mind of a kid who was a bit of a nerd and, you know, bullied at school or bullied after school, whatever. Got in that kid's mind and made him believe that he could achieve that. And he did. He took him step by step along that path until he believed, going into that ring. I remember because he came right down next to where his granddad was and sort of pumped fists with his granddad. He believed when he got in that ring that he was going to win the fight and nothing was going to stop him. And that's what sustained him in that ninth round, you know. And I honestly believe only Glenn Rushton could have gotten in the kid's head like that and made him, taken him from nerd to, you know, great world champion.
From nerd.
I think even just touching on the intensity, Grantley, like I remember Shane Mosley Jr. come to our gym and you said, these guys say they train for 2-3 hours, but half of it's just getting your hand wraps on.
Yeah, half
and
of
just,
it's looking
they're
in
just
the mirror.
Dicking around.
Just
yeah, yeah.
In the mirror. Yeah.
And just the fact you touched on that, that's exactly what you said as well back then. Because he lost on that night too. He lost to Dave Toussaint.
Oh, what an amazing day for Australian boxing that was. Even if Jeff had lost, that would have still been a great day for Australian boxers,
massive.
You know? Like, and
like you were just saying with Damien Hooper, you know, that was a good huge big win. And to Saints win was a terrific win, you know, over good fighters. Mm. And they had the light flyweight world title fight as well, you know, the Japanese guy.
Yeah. Oh,
and Michael Condon was on too.
Yeah, that's right.
Jared, what's his last name?
Hank Ahad. Oh, Jared, from
Fortitude.
Steve Deller's gym.
Yeah, yeah.
Juarez, they call him.
Yes.
I can't remember.
Jared Owen.
Jared, yes,
there
it was.
You go.
There we go. Again, Grantley remembers.
Yeah, he's onto it.
It was a phenomenal day, wasn't it? You know, it was even bigger. It was an even bigger occasion than, as I say, Bruno and Bugner. But I wasn't in the corner for any of those fights, so the Bruno Bugner one was for me the most intense atmosphere because
you've been involved with
it.
Yeah, mate. I look. You've seen more great Australian moments than me in sport. But, mate, I can't top it. I cannot top that with anything.
To me, like I keep saying to Jeff, Jeff was a bit downcast after he lost to Terence Crawford and then lost the fight with, and then, of course, with Tim Zhu. But I keep saying to him, mate, no one ever can do what you've done, you know. Mm. To go from a bookish kid at school to beating Manny Pacquiao within a few that's the greatest story of all time, you know, and to still be a good bloke at the end of it all, you know. I just think, to me, he's just such a great Australian hero. And that moment wasn't just a great moment in Australian boxing. It's one of the greatest moments ever in Australian sport.
That's what I put it up there. I can't see, like, I don't know, Test match wins. You get excited by them, and whatever sport, cricket, rugby league, I don't know, World Cup wins. For Jeff to beat Manny Pacquiao, that has to top everything. That has to top everything.
Mate. Who would have thought that, you know, a few years before? You know, like, it's amazing how lives turn out and change, isn't it? You know, who would have thought when he was going to high school and getting picked on and whatever, on a few years I'll be, you know, battering Manny Pacquiao before 50,000 people at some court.
Crazy.
It's just crazy.
And he was just, when he's on a podcast, he said, mate, he said, I didn't even realise before I could, a few weeks ago, I could walk down the street. He said, and the minute that fight's over, I walk out of the dressing room and I'm just a different person. And he said, I can't remember how long he said it went on for. He said, but gradually, I can walk down the street now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But he said, for that, like, you know, probably that next 6 months there, it was madness.
Yeah. He's a very modest guy, you know, like he didn't milk his fame for what he could have. You know, someone like a Jeff Fenwick would have, you know, built on that and built on that and built on that. But Jeff's a very laid-back kind of guy. Jeff Horn's a very laid-back character.
Mate, you just mentioned Jeff Fenwick again. Did you watch the fight last week?
Which one?
Hass Hamden and Justin Frost.
Yeah. Once again,
Jeff using his experience.
He's a very, very strong personality. Yeah. I remember the great old, there used to be a great old fight announcer, Ray Connolly. He was the guy that used to use the big words. He used to say, glittering ominously down Glovedom's Glory Road. You know, he was great. Jeff Fenwick took him for a drive somewhere. He said, he drives very aggressively, doesn't he?
Mate, they mentioned Jeff himself in the interview after, mentioned the Jeff Fenwick privileges.
Yeah, the Jeff Fenwick privileges, yeah.
At least he owned it. Oh, that was against Frosty, wasn't it? Justin Frost.
So outside, I know we spoke a lot about boxing, Grantley, but outside of boxing, you've written a few books as well. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I've got, I think, Knockouts number 22, I think, that I've written. I wrote lots of sports books in the 80s. I wrote the Jeff Fenwick story, and I wrote a book on the history of Australian boxing and a book on cricket. Quite a few different books. But since about 2010, I've been concentrating on big Australian books on Australian history.
Yeah, because I saw, did you know a Ned Kelly book as well?
Well, I wrote the story, it's called Mrs. Kelly, the story of his mother, and also a book on the hunt for Ned Kelly. So that was a particular of interest. But I've written biographies of big Australian characters, Banjo Patterson, Henry Lawson, Governor Lachlan Macquarie, Joseph Banks, the great botanist. And I've got one coming out at Christmas time on Matthew Flinders, who was the first European guy to circumnavigate Australia and map most of Australia. In fact, the maps we use of Australia even now are pretty much based on what he did back in the early 1800s. And I've got a new book coming out next week called Knockout. It's all my favourite boxing stories. Yeah, awesome.
What kind of led you down that path to explore Australian history a bit more?
Yeah, well, it's quite weird, you know. I was up in Bundaberg and I visiting my brother's family, and he had little grandkids, and I decided to take their mother and the kids out for the day, a little day trip, and we went to a place called the Hinkler Hall of Aviation, which celebrates the life of Bert Hinkler, who was a great Australian aviator. He was the first man to fly solo from England to Australia, and his aeroplane's in the museum in Brisbane, the Queensland Museum in Brisbane. And I was just intrigued by his story. I just thought it was a phenomenal story. And the thing that really hooked me, they had just a little photo in the corner of a girl he married in America while he was living in England. And he was not really a bigamist, but he more or less had two wives on the go at the one time. And I just thought, that's such an intriguing sort of a character. What made this guy tick? And at the same time, he's a globe-trotting aviator and, you know, this brilliant adventurer. So I wrote his book, and it was quite successful. And the publishers, HarperCollins, asked me to write a biography of the great World War I General John Monash, and that did quite well. And so I started really enjoying the process of learning about these people myself and then telling other people the stories of these great Australians. And for the last 10 years, that's pretty much what I've been doing.
Yeah, that's unreal, mate.
Yeah, no, yeah. I enjoy it, yeah.
Bit of a change of pace from the sport, obviously,
well,
as well.
Well, yeah, but I suppose, like, in the career, I've always found... We're talking about boxing. I've always found covering boxing as absolutely fascinating because of the characters and the people you meet. And I think the sport of boxing, more than any other, I mean, people have spoken about this in the past. George Foreman used to always say boxing was the heavyweight championship of sports, because the characters that you meet and the drama and the intrigue and the pathos and the comedy and whatever other emotions are magnified in boxing more than they are in team sports, I guess, because it's one-on-one. And the fight for survival is really the fight for survival. You know, you get fighters from all sorts of backgrounds. You know, as we're saying, Jeff Horn, a bullied kid who ends up conquering the world, you know, conquering this great champion. You can only really have that at that level on a one-on-one sport. It's not so much a team sport. Mm. So I always found boxing... You know, people used to say, oh, why don't you cover more football? And the editors of the papers always wanted me to do more on other sports, but I love covering boxing largely because of the intrigue and the fascination I had with the characters that you would meet from all sorts of walks of life, often the shady sides of life. You know, it was an endless source of fascination for me, and I love covering it. And that's probably why, you know, a lot of the great novelists of our time have covered boxing and have been intrigued by boxing. Even people like Ernest Hemingway, you know, he used to say that boxing was the best left hooker he ever saw, because you'd be travelling... A fight was like life. You'd be travelling along, seemingly everything okay, and then something out of the blue would lay you flat. And that's what life is like, and that's what the sport of boxing can be like. You know, the old saying, you're only ever 10 seconds from disaster in the sport, so all the emotions and all the excitement of the sport are amplified magnificently.
Well, it's been great.
It has been.
It's been my pleasure, really. I really enjoyed having a chat, really did.
Mate, it's been really good listening to the stories and the names that you know, and... As Jack said, the memory that you have is unbelievable. I suppose in your world it has to be, I suppose.
I probably know most of the guys you've had on the podcast. I listened to Paul Milner the other day, and what a gentleman he was. I covered all his stuff before the Olympics in 2000, you know, and a great boxer too.
Oh, mate, he was one of the best technicians.
Yeah, brilliant.
Unfortunately, his professional career didn't go where
he trained with Johnny Lewis too.
He did too.
He was up at the gym. I remember he came over to Germany with us when Danny Green fought Marcus Bayer. He was Green's main sparring partner. And Green had a lot of trouble with him in the gym, more probably with Paul Miller than he did with Marcus Bayer in the fight. He was a very, very slick boxer and a lovely guy. Lovely guy.
Excellent. Who were you on for Green Mundine fights?
Who am I?
Who were you on? Who was going to win?
Danny Green was always my pal. Yeah, I remember in the first Mundine fight, he stuck his head. Anthony was winning the fight. After a bit of a shaky start, he stuck his head, headed through the ropes and poked his tongue at me. I remember that. Yeah. I backed the wrong horse.
Well, mate, it's been a pleasure having you on. And, mate, I'm sure a lot of our listeners will get a lot of pleasure from listening to this.
100%.
Mate, thank you very much, Grantley. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on. Really, really enjoyed it.
Thank you.